constitution would be sufficient to bring about the destruction of the nation, slowly but surely. This Judaizing of our spiritual life and mammonizing of our natural instinct for procreation will sooner or later work havoc with our whole posterity. For instead of strong, healthy children, blessed with natural feelings, we shall see the miserable specimens of humanity resulting from economic calculation. For economic considerations are becoming more and more the foundations of marriage, and the sole preliminary condition of it. And love looks for an outlet elsewhere. Here, as elsewhere, one may defy nature for a certain period of time, but sooner or later she will take her inexorable revenge. And when man realizes this truth, it is often too late. Our own nobility furnishes an example of the devastating consequences that follow from a persistent refusal to recognize the primary conditions necessary for normal wedlock. Here we are openly brought face to face with the results of those reproductive habits which, on the one hand, are determined by social pressure, and, on the other, by financial considerations. The one leads to inherited debility, and the other to adulteration of the blood strain, for all the Jewish daughters of the department store proprietors are looked upon as eligible mates to cooperate in propagating his lordship's stock. And the stock certainly looks it. All this leads to absolute degeneration. Nowadays, our bourgeois are making efforts to follow in the same path. They will come to the same journey's end. These unpleasant truths are hastily and nonchalantly brushed aside, as if by doing so the real state of affairs could also be abolished. But no, it cannot be denied that the population of our great towns and cities is tending more and more to a veil of prostitution in the exercise of its amorous instincts, and is thus becoming more and more contaminated by the scourge of venereal disease. On the one hand, the visible effects of this mass infection can be observed in our insane asylums, and on the other hand, alas, among the children at home. These are the doleful and tragic witnesses to the steadily increasing scourge that is poisoning our sexual life. Their sufferings are the visible results of parental vice. There are many ways of becoming resigned to this unpleasant and terrible fact. Many people go about seeing nothing, or, to be more correct, not wanting to see anything. This is by far the simplest and cheapest attitude to adopt. Others cover themselves in the sacred mantle of prudery, as ridiculous as it is false. They describe the whole condition of affairs as sinful, and are profoundly indignant when brought face to face with a victim. They close their eyes in reverent abhorrence to this godless scourge, and pray to the Almighty that He, if possible after their own death, may rain down fire and brimstone as on Sodom and Gomorrah, and so once again make an outstanding example of this shameless section of humanity. Finally, there are those who are well aware of the terrible results which this scourge will and must bring about, but they merely shrug their shoulders, fully convinced of their inability to undertake anything against this peril. Hence, matters are allowed to take their own course. Undoubtedly, all this is very convenient and simple, only it must not be overlooked that this convenient way of approaching things can have fatal consequences for our natural life. The excuse that other nations are also not faring any better does not alter the fact of our own deterioration, except that the feeling of sympathy for other stricken nations makes our own suffering easier to bear. But the important question that arises here is, which nation will be the first to take the initiative in mastering this scourge, and which nations will succumb to it? This will be the final upshot of the whole situation. The present is a period of probation for racial values. The race that fails to come through the test will simply die out, and its place will be taken by the healthier and stronger races, which will be able to endure greater hardships. As this problem primarily concerns posterity, it belongs to that category of which it is said with terrible justification that the sins of the fathers are visited on their offspring unto the 10th generation. This is a consequence which follows on an infringement of the laws of blood and race. The sin against blood and race is the hereditary sin in this world, and it brings disaster on every nation that commits it. The attitude towards this one vital problem in pre-war Germany was most regrettable. What measures were undertaken to arrest the infection of our youth in the large cities? What was done to put an end to the contamination and mammonization of sexual life among us? What was done to fight the resultant spreading of syphilis throughout the whole of our national life? The reply to this question can best be illustrated by showing what should have been done. Instead of tackling this problem in a haphazard way, the authorities should have realized that the fortunes or misfortunes of future generations depended on its solution. But to admit this would have demanded that active measures be carried out in a ruthless manner. The primary condition would have been that the enlightened attention of the whole country should be concentrated on this terrible danger, so that every individual would realize the importance of fighting against it. It would be futile to impose obligations of a definite character, which are often difficult to bear, and expect them to become generally effective, unless the public be thoroughly instructed on the necessity of imposing and accepting such obligations. This demands a widespread and systematic method of enlightenment, and all other daily problems that might distract public attention from this great central problem should be relegated to the background.
File 53.
In every case where there are exigencies or tasks that seem impossible to deal with successfully, public opinion must be concentrated on the one problem, under the conviction that the solution of this problem alone is a matter of life or death. Only in this way can public interest be aroused to such a pitch as will urge people to combine in a great voluntary effort and achieve important results. This fundamental truth applies also to the individual, provided he is desirous of attaining some great end. He must always concentrate his efforts to one definitely limited stage of his progress, which has to be completed before the next step be attempted. Those who do not endeavour to realise their aims step by step, and who do not concentrate their energy in reaching the individual stages, will never attain the final objective. At some stage or other, they will falter and fail. This systematic way of approaching an objective is an art in itself, and always calls for the expenditure of every ounce of energy in order to conquer step after step of the road. Therefore, the most essential preliminary condition necessary for an attack on such a difficult stage of the human road is that the authorities should succeed in convincing the masses that the immediate objective which is now being fought for is the only one that deserves to be considered and the only one on which everything depends. The broad masses are never able clearly to see the whole stretch of the road lying in front of them without becoming tired and thus losing faith in their ability to complete the task. To a certain extent, they will keep the objective in mind, but they are only able to survey the whole road in small stages, as in the case of the traveller who knows where his journey is going to end, but who masters the endless stretch far better by attacking it in degrees. Only this way can he keep up his determination to reach the final objective. It is in this way, with the assistance of every form of propaganda, that the problem of fighting venereal disease should be placed before the public, not as a task for the nation, but as the main task. Every possible means should be employed to bring the truth about this scourge home to the minds of the people, until the whole nation has been convinced that everything depends on the solution of this problem. That is to say, a healthy future or national decay. Only after such preparatory measures, if necessary spread over a period of many years, will public attention and public resolution be fully aroused, and only then can serious and definite measures be undertaken without running the risk of not being fully understood, or of being suddenly faced with a slackening of the public will. It must be made clear to all that a serious fight against this scourge calls for vast sacrifices and an enormous amount of work. To wage war against syphilis means fighting against prostitution, against prejudice, against old established customs, against current fashion, public opinion, and last, but not least, against false prudery in certain circles. The first preliminary condition to be fulfilled before the state can claim a moral right to fight against all these things is that the young generation should be afforded facilities for contracting early marriages. Late marriages have the sanction of a custom which, from whatever angle we view it, is and will remain a disgrace to humanity. Prostitution is a disgrace to humanity, and cannot be removed simply by charitable or academic methods. Its restriction and final extermination presupposes the removal of a whole series of contributory circumstances. The first remedy must always be to establish such conditions as will make early marriages possible, especially for young men. For women are, after all, only passive subjects in this matter. An illustration of the extent to which people have so often been led astray nowadays is afforded by the fact that not infrequently one hears mothers in so-called better circles openly expressing their satisfaction at having found as a husband for their daughter a man who has already sown his wild oats, etc. As there is usually so little shortage in men of this type, the poor girl finds no difficulty in getting a mate of this description, and the children of this marriage are a visible result of such supposedly sensible unions. When one realizes, apart from this, that every possible effort is being made to hinder the process of procreation, and that nature is being wilfully cheated of her rights, there remains really only one question. Why is such an institution as marriage still in existence? And what are its functions? Is it really nothing better than prostitution? Does our duty to posterity no longer play any part? Or do people not realize the nature of the curse they are inflicting upon themselves and their offspring by such criminally foolish neglect of one of the primary laws of nature? This is how civilized nations degenerate and gradually perish. Marriage is not an end in itself, but must serve the greater end, which is that of increasing and maintaining the human species and the race. This is its only meaning and purpose. This being admitted, then it is clear that the institution of marriage must be judged by the manner in which its allotted function is fulfilled. Therefore, early marriages should be the rule, because thus the young couple will still have that pristine force which is the fountainhead of a healthy prosperity with unimpaired powers of resistance. Of course, early marriages cannot be made the rule unless a whole series of social measures are first undertaken, without which early marriages cannot be even thought of. In other words, a solution of this question, which seems a small problem in itself, cannot be brought about without adopting radical measures to alter the social background. The importance of such measures ought to be studied and properly estimated, especially at a time when the so-called social republic has shown itself unable to solve the housing problem, and thus has made it impossible for innumerable couples to get married. That sort of policy prepares the way for the further advance of prostitution. Another reason why early marriages are impossible is our nonsensical method of regulating the scale of salaries, which pays far too little attention to the problem of family support. Prostitution, therefore, can only be really seriously tackled if, by means of a radical social reform, early marriage is made easier than hitherto. This is the first preliminary necessity for the solution of this problem. Secondly, a whole series of false notions must be eradicated from our system of bringing up and educating children, things which hitherto no one seems to have worried about. In our present educational system, a balance will have to be established first and foremost between mental instruction and physical training. What is known as gymnasium, grammar school, today, is a positive insult to the Greek institution. Our system of education entirely loses sight of the fact that in the long run, a healthy mind can exist only in a healthy body. This statement, with few exceptions, applies particularly to the broad masses of the nation. In the pre-war Germany, there was a time when no one took the trouble to think over this truth. Training of the body was criminally neglected, the one-sided training of the mind being regarded as sufficient guarantee for the nation's greatness. This mistake was destined to show its effects sooner than had been anticipated. It is not pure chance that the Bolshevik teaching flourishes in those regions whose degenerate population has been brought to the verge of starvation, as, for example, in the case of Central Germany, Saxony, and the Ruhr Valley. In all these districts there is a marked absence of any serious resistance, even by the so-called intellectual classes, against this Jewish contagion. And the simple reason is that the intellectual classes are themselves physically degenerate, not through privation, but through education. The exclusive intellectualism of the education in vogue among our upper classes makes them unfit for life's struggle at an epoch in which physical force and not mind is the dominating factor. Thus, they are neither capable of maintaining themselves nor of making their way in life. In nearly every case, physical disability is the forerunner of personal cowardice. The extravagant emphasis laid on purely intellectual education and the consequent neglect of physical training must necessarily lead to sexual thoughts in early youth. Those boys whose constitutions have been trained and hardened by sports and gymnastics are less prone to sexual indulgence than those stay-at-homes who have been fed exclusively with mental pabulum. Sound methods of education cannot, however, afford to disregard this, and we must not forget that the expectations of a healthy young man from a woman will differ from those of a weakling who has been prematurely corrupted. Thus, in every branch of our education, the day's curriculum must be arranged so as to occupy a boy's free time in profitable development of his physical powers. He has no right in those years to loaf about, becoming a nuisance in public streets and in cinemas. But when his day's work is done, he ought to harden his young body so that his strength may not be found wanting when the occasion arises. To prepare for this and to carry it out should be the function of our educational system, and not exclusively to pump in knowledge or wisdom. Our school system must also rid itself of the notion that the training of the body is a task that should be left to the individual himself. There is no such thing as allowing freedom of choice to sin against posterity, and thus against the race.
54.
The fight against pollution of the mind must be waged simultaneously with the training of the body. Today, the whole of our public life may be compared to a hothouse for the forced growth of sexual notions and incitements. A glance at the bill of fare provided by our cinemas, playhouses and theatres suffices to prove that this is not the right food, especially for our young people. Hoardings and advertisement kiosks combine to attract the public in the most vulgar manner. Anyone who has not altogether lost contact with adolescent yearnings will realise that all this must have very grave consequences. This seductive and sensuous atmosphere puts notions into the heads of our youth which, at their age, ought still to be unknown to them. Unfortunately, the results of this kind of education can best be seen in our contemporary youth, who are prematurely grown up, and therefore old before their time. The law courts, from time to time, throw a distressing light on the spiritual life of our 14- and 15-year-old children. Who, therefore, will be surprised to learn that venereal disease claims its victims at this age? And is it not a frightful shame to see the number of physically weak and intellectually spoiled young men who have been introduced to the mysteries of marriage by the whores of the big cities? No, those who want seriously to combat prostitution must first of all assist in removing the spiritual conditions on which it thrives. They will have to clean up the moral pollution of our city culture fearlessly and without regard for the outcry that will follow. If we do not drag our youth out of the morass of their present environment, they will be engulfed by it. Those people who do not want to see these things are deliberately encouraging them and are guilty of spreading the effects of prostitution to the future, for the future belongs to our young generation. This process of cleaning our culture will have to be applied in practically all spheres. The stage, art, literature, the cinema, the press and advertisement posters, all must have the stains of pollution removed and be placed in the service of a national and cultural idea. The life of the people must be freed from the asphyxiating perfume of our modern eroticism, and also from every unmanly and prudish form of insincerity. In all these things, the aim and the method must be determined by thoughtful consideration for the preservation of our national well-being, in body and soul. The right to personal freedom comes second in importance to the duty of maintaining the race. Only after such measures have been put into practice can a medical campaign against this scourge begin with some hope of success. But here again, half-measures will be valueless. Far-reaching and important decisions will have to be made. It would be doing things by halves if incurables were given the opportunity of infecting one healthy person after another. This would be that kind of humanitarianism which would allow hundreds to perish in order to save the suffering of one individual. The demand that it should be made impossible for defective people to continue to propagate defective offspring is a demand that is based on most reasonable grounds, and its proper fulfilment is the most humane task that mankind has to face. Unhappy and undeserved suffering in millions of cases will be spared, with the result that there will be a gradual improvement in national health. A determined decision to act in this manner will at the same time provide an obstacle against the further spread of venereal disease. It would then be a case, where necessary, of mercilessly isolating all incurables. Perhaps a barbaric measure for those unfortunates, but a blessing for the present generation and for posterity. The temporary pain thus experienced in this century can and will spare future thousands of generations from suffering. The fight against syphilis and its pacemaker prostitution is one of the gigantic tasks of mankind. Gigantic because it is not merely a case of solving a single problem, but the removal of a whole series of evils which are the contributory causes of this scourge. Disease of the body, in this case, is merely the result of a diseased condition of the moral, social, and racial instincts. But if, for reasons of indolence or cowardice, this fight is not fought to a finish, we may imagine what conditions will be like 500 years hence. Little of God's image will be left in human nature except to mock the Creator. But what has been done in Germany to counteract this scourge? If we think calmly over the answer, we shall find it distressing. It is true that in governmental circles the terrible and injurious effects of this disease were well known. But the countermeasures which were officially adopted were ineffective and a hopeless failure. They tinkered with cures for the symptoms, wholly regardless of the cause of the disease. Prostitutes were medically examined and controlled as far as possible, and when signs of infection were apparent, they were sent to hospital. When outwardly cured, they were once more let loose on humanity. It is true that protective legislation was introduced which made sexual intercourse a punishable offence for all those not completely cured, or those suffering from venereal disease. This legislation was correct in theory, but in practice it failed completely. In the first place, in the majority of cases, women will decline to appear in court as witnesses against men who have robbed them of their health. Women would be exposed far more than men to uncharitable remarks in such cases, and one can imagine what their position would be if they had been infected by their own husbands. Should women, in that case, lay a charge? Or what should they do? In the case of the man, there is the additional fact that he frequently is unfortunate enough to run up against this danger when he is under the influence of alcohol. His condition makes it impossible for him to assess the qualities of his amorous beauty, a fact which is well known to every diseased prostitute, and makes them single out men in this ideal condition for preference. The result is that the unfortunate man is not able to recollect later on who his compassionate benefactress was, which is not surprising in cities like Berlin and Munich. Many of such cases are visitors from the provinces, who, held speechless and enthralled by the magic charm of city life, become an easy prey for prostitutes. In the final analysis, who is able to say whether he has been infected or not? Are there not innumerable cases on record where an apparently cured person has a relapse and does untold harm without knowing it? Therefore, in practice, the results of these legislative measures are negative. The same applies to the control of prostitution. And finally, even medical treatment and cure are nowadays unsafe and doubtful. One thing only is certain. The scourge has spread further and further, in spite of all measures, and this alone suffices definitely to stamp and substantiate their inefficiency. Everything else that was undertaken was just as inefficient as it was absurd. The spiritual prostitution of the people was neither arrested, nor was anything whatsoever undertaken in this direction. Those, however, who do not regard this subject as a serious one, would do well to examine the statistical data of the spread of this disease, study its growth in the last century, and contemplate the possibilities of its further development. The ordinary observer, unless he were particularly stupid, would experience a cold shudder if the position were made clear to him. The half-hearted and wavering attitude adopted in pre-war Germany towards this iniquitous condition can assuredly be taken as a visible sign of national decay. When the courage to fight for one's own health is no longer in evidence, then the right to live in this world of struggle also ceases. One of the visible signs of decay in the old Reich was the slow setback which the general cultural level experienced. But by culture, I do not mean that which we nowadays style as civilization, which, on the contrary, may rather be regarded as inimical to the spiritual elevation of life. At the turn of the last century, A new element began to make its appearance in our world. It was an element which had been hitherto absolutely unknown and foreign to us. In former times there had certainly been offences against good taste, but these were mostly departures from the orthodox canons of art, and posterity could recognise a certain historical value in them. But the new products showed signs not only of artistic aberration, but of spiritual degeneration. Here, in the cultural sphere, the signs of the coming collapse first became manifest. The Bolshevization of art is the only cultural form of life and the only spiritual manifestation of which Bolshevism is capable. Anyone to whom this statement may appear strange need only take a glance at those lucky states which have become Bolshevized, and, to his horror, he will there recognize those morbid monstrosities which have been produced by insane and degenerate people. All those artistic aberrations which are classified under the names of Cubism and Dadaism, since the opening of the present century, are manifestations of art which have come to be officially recognized by the state itself. This phenomenon made its appearance even during the short-lived period of the Soviet Republic in Bavaria. At that time, one might easily have recognized how all the official posters, propagandist pictures, and newspapers, etc., showed signs not only of political, but also of cultural decadence. About 60 years ago, a political collapse such as we are experiencing today would have been just as inconceivable as the cultural decline which has been manifest in Cubist and Futurist pictures ever since 1900. 60 years ago, an exhibition of so-called dadistic experiences would have been an absolutely preposterous idea. The organizers of such an exhibition would then have been certified for the lunatic asylum, whereas today they are appointed presidents of art societies. At that time, such an epidemic would never have been allowed to spread. Public opinion would not have tolerated it, and the government would not have remained silent. For it is the duty of a government to save its people from being stampeded into such intellectual madness. But intellectual madness would have resulted from a development that followed the acceptance of this kind of art. It would have marked one of the worst changes in human history, for it would have meant that a retrogressive process had begun to take place in the human brain, the final stages of which would be unthinkable.
File 55.
If we study the course of our cultural life during the last 25 years, we shall be astonished to note how far we have already gone in this process of retrogression. Everywhere we find the presence of those germs which give rise to protuberant growths that must sooner or later bring about the ruin of our culture. Here we find undoubted symptoms of slow corruption, and woe to the nations that are no longer able to bring that morbid process to a halt. In almost all the various fields of German art and culture, those morbid phenomena may be observed. Here, everything seems to have passed the culminating point of its excellence, and to have entered the curve of a hasty decline. At the beginning of the century, the theatres seemed already degenerating and ceasing to be cultural factors, except the court theatres, which opposed this prostitution of the national art. With these exceptions, and also a few other decent institutions, the plays produced on the stage were of such a nature that the people would have benefited by not visiting them at all. A sad symptom of decline was manifested by the fact that in the case of many art centres, the sign was posted on the entrance doors, "For adults only." Let it be borne in mind that these precautions had to be taken in regard to institutions whose main purpose should have been to promote the education of the youth, and not merely to provide amusement for sophisticated adults. What would the great dramatists of other times have said of such measures, and, above all, of the conditions which made these measures necessary? How exasperated Schiller would have been, and how Goethe would have turned away in disgust. But what are Schiller, Goethe, and Shakespeare when confronted with the heroes of our modern German literature? Old and frowsy and outmoded and finished. For it was typical of this epoch that not only were its own products bad, but that the authors of such products and their backers reviled everything that had been really great in the past. This is a phenomenon that is very characteristic of such epochs. The more vile and miserable are the men and products of an epoch, the more they will hate and denigrate the ideal achievements of former generations. What these people would like best would be completely to destroy every vestige of the past, in order to do away with that sole standard of comparison which prevents their own daubs from being looked upon as art. Therefore, the more lamentable and wretched are the products of each new era, the more it will try to obliterate all the memorials of the past. But any real innovation that is for the benefit of mankind can always face comparison with the best of what has gone before, and frequently it happens that those monuments of the past guarantee the acceptance of those modern productions. There is no fear that modern productions of real worth will look pale and worthless beside the monuments of the past. What is contributed to the general treasury of human culture often fulfills a part that is necessary in order to keep the memory of old achievements alive, because this memory alone is the standard whereby our own works are properly appreciated. Only those who have nothing of value to give to the world will oppose everything that already exists, and would have it destroyed at all costs. And this holds good not only for new phenomena in the cultural domain, but also in politics. The more inferior new revolutionary movements are, the more will they try to denigrate the old forms. Here again, the desire to pawn off their shoddy products as great and original achievements leads them into a blind hatred against everything which belongs to the past and which is superior to their own work. As long as the historical memory of Frederick the Great, for instance, still lives, Frederick Ebert can arouse only a problematic admiration. The relation of the hero of Sanssouci to the former republican of Bremen may be compared to that of the sun to the moon, for the moon can shine only after the direct rays of the sun have left the earth. Thus we can readily understand why it is that all the new moons in human history have hated the fixed stars. In the field of politics, if fate should happen temporarily to place the ruling power in the hands of those non-entities, they are not only eager to defile and revile the past, but at the same time they will use all means to evade criticism of their own acts. The law for the protection of the Republic, which the new German state enacted, may be taken as one example of this truth. One has good grounds to be suspicious in regard to any new idea, or any doctrine or philosophy, any political or economic movement, which tries to deny everything that the past has produced, or to present it as inferior and worthless. Any renovation which is really beneficial to human progress will always have to begin its constructive work at the level where the last stones of the structure have been laid. It need not blush to utilize those truths which have already been established. For all human culture, as well as man himself, is only the result of one long line of development, where each generation has contributed but one stone to the building of the whole structure. The meaning and purpose of revolutions cannot be to tear down the whole building, but to take away what has not been well fitted into it, or is unsuitable, and to rebuild the free space thus caused, after which the main construction of the building will be carried on. Thus alone will it be possible to talk of human progress, for otherwise the world would never be free of chaos, since each generation would feel entitled to reject the past and destroy all the work of the past, as the necessary preliminary to any new work of its own. The saddest feature of the condition in which our whole civilization found itself before the war was the fact that it was not only barren of any creative force to produce its own works of art and civilization, but that it hated, defiled, and tried to efface the memory of the superior works produced in the past. About the end of the last century, people were less interested in producing new significant works of their own, particularly in the fields of dramatic art and literature, than in defaming the best works of the past and in presenting them as inferior and antiquated. As if this period of disgraceful decadence had the slightest capacity to produce anything of superior quality. The efforts made to conceal the past from the eyes of the present afforded clear evidence of the fact that these apostles of the future acted from an evil intent. These symptoms should have made it clear to all that it was not a question of new, though wrong, cultural ideas, but of a process which was undermining the very foundations of civilization. It threw the artistic feeling which had hitherto been quite sane into utter confusion, thus spiritually preparing the way for political Bolshevism. If the creative spirit of the Periclean age be manifested in the Parthenon, then the Bolshevist era is manifested through its cubist grimace. In this connection, attention must be drawn once again to the want of courage displayed by one section of our people, namely by those who, in virtue of their education and position, ought to have felt themselves obliged to take up a firm stand against this outrage on our culture. But they refrained from offering serious resistance and surrendered to what they considered the inevitable. This abdication of theirs was due, however, to sheer funk, lest the apostles of Bolshevist art might raise a rumpus. For those apostles always violently attacked everyone who was not ready to recognize them as the choice spirits of artistic creation, and they tried to strangle all opposition by saying that it was the product of Philistine and backwater minds. people trembled in fear, lest they might be accused by these yahoos and swindlers of lacking artistic appreciation, as if it would have been a disgrace not to be able to understand and appreciate the effusions of those mental degenerates or arrant rogues. Those cultural disciples, however, had a very simple way of presenting their own effusions as works of the highest quality. They offered incomprehensible and manifestly crazy productions to their amazed contemporaries as what they called an inner experience. Thus they forestalled all adverse criticism at very little cost indeed. Of course, nobody ever doubted that there could have been inner experiences like that, but some doubt ought to have arisen as to whether or not there was any justification for exposing these hallucinations of psychopaths or criminals to the sane portion of human society. The works produced by a Moritz von Schwind or a Birklin were also externalizations of an inner experience, but these were the experiences of divinely gifted artists, and not of buffoons.
File 56.
This situation offered a good opportunity of studying the miserable cowardliness of our so-called intellectuals, who shirked the duty of offering serious resistance to the poisoning of the sound instincts of our people. They left it to the people themselves to formulate their own attitude towards this impudent nonsense, lest they might be considered as understanding nothing of art. They accepted every caricature of art, until they finally lost the power of judging what is really good or bad. Taken all in all, there were superabundant symptoms to show that a diseased epoch had begun. Still another critical symptom has to be considered. In the course of the 19th century, our towns and cities began more and more to lose their character as centres of civilization and become more and more centres of habitation. In our great modern cities, the proletariat does not show much attachment to the place where it lives. This feeling results from the fact that their dwelling place is nothing but an accidental abode, and that feeling is also partly due to the frequent change of residence which is forced upon them by social conditions. There is no time for the growth of any attachment to the town in which they live. But another reason lies in the cultural barrenness and superficiality of our modern cities. At the time of the German Wars of Liberation, our German towns and cities were not only small in number, but also very modest in size. The few that could really be called great cities were mostly the residential cities of princes. As such, they had almost always a definite cultural value, and also a definite cultural aspect. Those few towns which had more than 50,000 inhabitants were, in comparison with modern cities of the same size, rich in scientific and artistic treasures. At the time when Munich had not more than 60,000 souls, it was already well on the way to becoming one of the first German centres of art. Nowadays, almost every industrial town has a population at least as large as that, without having anything of real value to call its own. They are agglomerations of tenement houses and congested dwelling barracks, and nothing else. It would be a miracle if anybody should grow sentimentally attached to such a meaningless place. Nobody can grow attached to a place which offers only just as much or as little as any other place would offer, which has no character of its own, and where obviously pains have been taken to avoid everything that might have any resemblance to an artistic appearance. But this is not all. Even the great cities become more barren of real works of art, the more they increase in population. They assume more and more a neutral atmosphere, and present the same aspect, though on a larger scale, as the wretched little factory towns. Everything that our modern age has contributed to the civilization of our great cities is absolutely deficient. All our towns are living on the glory and the treasures of the past. If we take away from the Munich of today everything that was created under Ludwig II, we should be horror-stricken to see how meagre has been the output of important artistic creations since that time. One might say much the same of Berlin and most of our other great towns. But the following is the essential thing to be noticed. Our great modern cities have no outstanding monuments that dominate the general aspect of the city and could be pointed to as the symbols of a whole epoch. Yet almost every ancient town had a monument erected to its glory. It was not in private dwellings that the characteristic art of ancient cities was displayed, but in the public monuments, which were not meant to have a transitory interest, but an enduring one. And this was because they did not represent the wealth of some individual citizen, but the greatness and importance of the community. It was under this inspiration that those monuments arose, which bound the individual inhabitants to their own town in a manner that is often almost incomprehensible to us today. What struck the eye of the individual citizen was not a number of mediocre private buildings, but imposing structures that belonged to the whole community. In contradistinction to these, private dwellings were of only very secondary importance indeed. When we compare the size of those ancient public buildings with that of the private dwellings belonging to the same epoch, then we can understand the great importance which was given to the principle that those works which reflected and affected the life of the community should take precedence of all others. Among the broken arches and vast spaces that are covered with ruins from the ancient world, the colossal riches that still arouse our wonder have not been left to us from the commercial palaces of these days, but from the temples of the gods and the public edifices that belonged to the state. The community itself was the owner of these great edifices. Even in the pomp of Rome during the decadence, it was not the villas and palaces of some citizens that filled the most prominent place, but rather the temples and the baths, the stadia, the circuses, the aqueducts, the basilicas, etc., which belonged to the state, and therefore to the people as a whole. In medieval Germany also the same principle held sway, although the artistic outlook was quite different. In ancient times, the theme that found its expression in the Acropolis or the Pantheon was now clothed in the forms of the Gothic cathedral. In the medieval cities, these monumental structures towered gigantically above the swarm of smaller buildings with their framework walls of wood and brick, and they remain the dominant feature of these cities even to our own day, although they are becoming more and more obscured by the apartment barracks. They determine the character and appearance of the locality. Cathedrals, city halls, corn exchanges, defence towers are the outward expression of an idea which has its counterpart only in the ancient world. The dimensions and quality of our public buildings today are in deplorable contrast to the edifices that represent private interests. If a similar fate should befall Berlin as befell Rome, future generations might gaze upon the ruins of some Jewish department stores or joint stock hotels and think that these were the characteristic